12.
We could read in verse 14 and make our comments talk to that as well. Ruth chapter 3 and verse 14. And she lay at his feet until the morning, and she rose up before one could know another. And he said, let it not be known that a woman came into the floor. Also he said, bring the veil that thou hast upon thee and hold it. And when she held it, he measured 6 measures of barley and laid it on her, and she went into the city. And when she came to her mother-in-law, she said, who art thou, my daughter? And she told her all that the man had done unto her. And she said, these 6 measures of barley gave he me, for he said unto me, go not empty unto thy mother-in-law. Then said she, sit still, my daughter, until thou know how the matter will fall, for the man will not be in rest until he have finished the thing this day. Then went Boaz up to the gate and sat down there, and behold, the kinsman of whom Boaz spake came by, unto whom he said, ho, such a one, turn aside, sit down here. And he turned aside and sat down. And he took 10 men of the elders of the city and said, sit ye down here. And they sat down. And he said unto the kinsman, Naomi that is come again out of the country of Moab selleth a parcel of land which was our brother Elimelech's. And I thought to advertise thee, saying, buy it before the inhabitants and before the elders of my people. And if thou wilt redeem it, redeem it. But if thou wilt not redeem it, then tell me that I may know, for there is none to redeem it beside thee, and I am after thee. And he said, I will redeem it. Then said Boaz, what day thou buyest the field of the hand of Naomi, thou must buy it also of Ruth the Moabitess, the wife of the dead, to raise up the name of the dead upon his inheritance. And the kinsman said, I cannot redeem it for myself, lest I mar mine own inheritance. Redeem thou my right to thyself, for I cannot redeem it. Now this was the manner in former time in Israel concerning redeeming and concerning changing. For to confirm all things, a man plucked off his shoe and gave it to his neighbor, and this was a testimony in Israel. Therefore the kinsman said unto Boaz, buy it for thee. So he drew off his shoe.
Perhaps could have even begun reading at verse 10. He may have given the wrong direction. You have to have patience.
It might be well to note that when she laid herself at the feet of Boaz, it was a public thing. It was not done in secret. She declared publicly whom now she belonged to, or whom her affections went to. I think that's. I think we'd make that application here. If you remember back in previous chapter, I'd just like to refer to the latter part of verse 13, where she said, "Though I be not like unto one of thine handmaidens," she was. That seemed to have the moral courage to be happy to be different. She acknowledged that she was not the same, and that here she publicly again takes a stand for to whom she belongs. So I would like to think that our relationship with the Lord Jesus is one of intimacy and very private and personal, but there is a public aspect of our relationship too that would honor him and I think give us moral courage too. But I remember in a cottage meeting a while ago, most of those present for the most part were not familiar with the assembly, and the young people, they were debating or speaking of the individuality necessary to express ourselves and so on. And it was interesting, I couldn't help but chuckle to see that most of them, they looked alike. They all wore their hair about the same, and their clothes were all the same. There's a subtle desire in the heart of each one of us to be the same, to belong to our peer group or whatever. It's a wonderful thing, a glorious thing, to be shaken loose from that trap and to glory, as it were, to be different, to be different. She was never ashamed, although it cost her something, to testify to her difference. So you can see where it concluded.
Among this public testimony, all the city knew that she was a virtuous woman. What a lovely testimony. You don't have to say it, but the city says it goes at sea. And virtue is something that is to be coveted and protected.
Now, in that 11th verse, "Now, my daughter," he's speaking to her, "fear not. I will do to thee all that thou requirest." That reminds me of some of those statements that the Lord Jesus made to his disciples before he went to the cross in the upper room, when he encouraged them to pray to the Father and so on. John 14:13-14, it says, "Whatsoever ye shall ask in my name, that will I do, that the Father may be glorified in the Son." And there are other verses we could read too. The 16th chapter brings up something the same. "Whatsoever you shall ask in the Father in my name, he will give it you." And so the Lord would like to give us our desires. But those desires must be according, of course, to God. You find that in that verse that I read in John 14, that there is a clause there that says that the Father may be glorified in the Son. It's not that the Lord just answers every prayer that we have, and maybe some fleshly prayer with a false motive in it, but that the Father may be glorified in the Son. And there's a number of verses in the New Testament show that the Lord would love to answer our requests and fill our desires when they are desires that have been born of the Spirit of God, that are of Himself. And so she has this desire to be united to Him. Well, is that the desire that you and I should have as the bride of Christ, the ones who are going to share that glory with Him? Well, yes, it is. And the Lord is going to fulfill that desire that we have.
Has he ever failed to satisfy a desire, would you say?
No, not when there are desires born of that new nature and the Spirit of God.
That verse that we all are familiar with, "Delight thyself in the Lord, and He will give thee desire of thy heart." The delighting always comes first, precedes the desires granted. When I delight in Him, then my desires will be in tune with His.
But sometimes we do seek from the Lord things that are we think may be right, and we may have our motives, but the Lord, as it says in Samuel, that He is a God of knowledge, and by Him actions are weighed, and He's able to weigh the motives of our hearts, and only what is going to glorify the Father and be good for our blessing is what He gives. You've probably heard the illustration that C.H. Brown once gave of the fellow that went to the local grocery store. It was in the days when there was a general store, you could buy pretty well everything there, and at the end of the month, whatever, you would go and pay your bill, they'd just keep a running tab. And some fellow, his illustration was, he shows up to the store with a note, and on the note it says, "One box of cigars, signed C.H. Brown." The storekeeper looks at it. The man has come in Mr. Brown's name. As we say, if you ask in His name, He will give it. But yet the storekeeper refuses the request. Now why? Well, the storekeeper says, "Well, I know Mr. Brown, and he wouldn't want cigars. I know the character of the man. He doesn't smoke cigars. He's a Christian. He wants to please the Lord. He has no desire for those kind of things. Even though you have come in his name, I'm not going to be granting this request. And so to ask in his name is to ask according to the character of the person. And so if it's in keeping with the character of the one with whom we have been brought into relationship with, the Lord delights to fulfill those desires in answering our prayers, that the Father may be glorified in the Son. Is that right?
Now we must look at this kinsman law back in, referring to the 12th verse here, the kinsman back in the 25th chapter of Deuteronomy, where we, I think, have to turn to understand what principles are underlying what's going on here. In the 25th chapter of Deuteronomy, in verse 20, verse 5, if brethren dwell together and one of them die and have no child, the wife of the dead shall not marry without the family unto a stranger. Her husband's brother shall go in unto her and take her to him as his wife and perform the duty of a husband's brother unto her. And so on. This was for two reasons, I suppose, or probably more. I suppose the first thought could be that it was to protect the womanhood of the people of Israel. It really was a tremendous provision for her, that she was going to be provided for. And secondly, of course, it could be thought to protect the land that would stay, it had to stay within the family. Of course, every jubilee period, it would all return to the original owners. But it would protect the womanhood, and it would make provisions for the land that it remained in the family. So you can see why the kinsman aspect here was so vital, that they appealed to. And of course, in this man, Boaz, he met every requirement of a kinsman redeemer. That is, kinsman had to be a near kinsman. He must be willing to redeem. Not only that, he must be willing, but he also must be able to redeem. And he must have the price of redemption himself. And he must be also free to redeem. So those qualifications all were met by Boaz. And of course, the true Boaz, as we think of our Lord Jesus, how much more he was qualified to be our kinsman redeemer. I was thinking of that, Ron, and having three brothers. Yeah, when my older brother was thinking of getting married, all of the rest of us would have liked to have something to say as to who he married, because there might come a time when we would have to, in the old economy we're speaking of, we'd have to take his wife if he was taken.
Obstacles in the way, and God has put those obstacles there for more than one reason, but mainly the reason to deepen the love between the two that are going to enter into that union. And I'm sure we all can reflect back to when we were anticipating marriage, that there were things that were in the way that had to be taken care of, that maybe prolonged it a little bit. I'm sure David Tony won't mind me bringing his name up here. When he anticipated marrying his Brazilian wife, Lou, boy, it frightened any of us to go down to the city of São Paulo of 16 million people and expect to survive there. But the law demanded that he had to go to Rio de Janeiro or to get the legal matters taken care of. Well, David, you know, is a timid brother, but love didn't join him, and he went, and lo and behold, after he made that mission, why, it failed on him, and he had to go back again later on. And just to go into that city is enough to frighten a stout heart, even to the extent of getting held up with a gun and pickpocketed and things like that. But he faced all that, and so did Lou. And it's just lovely to see them happily married. But the Lord puts those things there for a reason, and we may chafe and say, well, I want to ignore it. Let us accept it. There's a divine purpose of love behind it.
There's a difficulty here as well, wasn't there?
There was one that was near East Boaz, and something had to be done. Still had a question mark. What was going to be the result of this very attractive move that she had made to come into the threshing floor to lay at his feet? He tells her, it is true that I am thy near kinsman. Howbeit, there is a kinsman near in mine. There was something here that had to go. I do think that there's these things that come along in life. When there's Christ before us, and if our affections are set on Him, difficulties will not daunt us, so to speak. We'll want to be where He's at. Just a very practical thought as well. The Lord has promised to be where two or three are gathered together into His name. Oh, there should be nothing that we would allow to keep us from coming to the meeting. The Lord's promised to be there, the one that has won our affection. But there should be nothing that we would allow to keep us from being where He's at. There's a difficulty that has to be overcome here. There's often difficulties in the Christian life, but the love for Christ, I think, would overcome those difficulties and find a way to be where He would have us to be.
And so her part was to lay at His feet until morning. Wait until that time when He would go to the gate and settle that matter. And so, as we have been explaining in the last meeting, how that laying at His feet is the thought of getting in the presence of the Lord and enjoying communion and fellowship with Him, and showing our subjection and our all to Him. But it's until the morning. Now, the morning usually brings before us the thought of the Lord's coming, doesn't it? And so our portion is to abide in Him. Without me, you can do nothing. John 15 tells us that the importance of abiding in Him and to enjoy that fellowship of communion with Him all through the night of His absence. You know, communion and fellowship with the Lord Jesus should not be an intermittent thing. That we get the idea, well, I have a little fellowship with the Lord every Lord's Day when I come to meeting, and I'll pick up where I left off next Lord's Day. That's not really what the Lord would have for us. Fellowship and communion with our Lord Jesus is something that should continue through the Christian life. It's a daily thing. It's something that we should be happy to be engaged with.
I don't know if I could have had the spirit of Boaz. When he is recognizing there's a kinsman that has a first claim on this woman, could quietly say, lie down until morning. I mean, we'll deal with this later. But he was willing to it gave peace to his soul. Know that God was in this and I can leave it with Him. I don't have to try to, by human means, to interfere. Interject my own desires here, but I can trust the Lord to work it out. And so that thought of lying until morning, it gives us a sense of the peace, I think, that he was feeling and being in the mind of and the will of God.
Question, why is it that he did not want it to be known that a woman would come to the floor and told her to rise up before morning and to go. Is there a thought that we are to get here out of this?
Someone to help us out on that. I wondered that myself. It could be that he did not want the other kinsmen to become acquainted with the situation any more than he had to until he had presented his case. And we're going to find how wisely he does that. But it could be that he didn't want to make it any more public than necessary.
I think we all also have had some very precious moments individually in the presence of Christ. And I think they're to be treasured. There are things we can learn there that we can share with others, no doubt. I think those precious moments, those little quiet times with the Lord, they can be kept as valuable, precious to the heart. Just another little thought, I'm sure there are others that have some, but to guard with all that we have those precious moments that no one else can have. We can't really share those, what we might call those intimate moments with the Lord, with everyone. It's something just between ourselves and Him. And that's, I think, one of the secrets of going on with the Lord, that we have those times to be enjoying Himself in His presence.
In the book of Acts, don't you see something similar when Paul says, I confer not with flesh and blood? But he meant he went and departed immediately. And I think that there's a time right after salvation where there should be a confirming in the things of the Lord. And when you've just been silly, get close to Christ, bury your face in His garment, get a sense of His presence that you will never lose. And, you know, if you make that drink early on, I think there's a total scriptural precedent for doing that.
Brethren, could we speak up so all can hear?
Might just make reference to Jeremiah 31:22 in respect to this question of let it not be known of the woman coming into the threshing floor. Verse 22 reads, how long wilt thou go about, O thou backsliding daughter? For the Lord hath created a new thing in the earth, a woman shall, it should read, encompass a man. Now, I believe that this is the restoration of Israel spoken of here when they cease to be the tail and once more become the head. Now, this is going to be a wonderful thing when Israel is restored to their Messiah. But I believe that there are many secrets that are kept in relation to how all that came about, that the nations will never know, because that is between the Lord and their Messiah. So there might be a hint of that in connection with this expression here.
As we consider what it is that Ruth has already had to go through. It might be also on the heart of Boaz to not bring any further unnecessary reproach before her. She's gone through quite a bit already. I think the Lord keeps us at times from things that others might not understand. Wondered if this also might be a little thought that we could draw in here. Others might not have really understood her being there in the threshing floor at his feet. He understood. He knew all about it. He knew the heart. He knew the reason, but others might not. I think the Lord protects us a little bit from some of the misunderstandings of others.
And before she goes, we find that he asked her to spread her veil or an apron. and he's going to give her 6 measures of barley. Now, we mentioned this last meeting, but it needs to be repeated again as we take this verse up, that when she gleaned in his field, she took 1 ephah of barley. That's chapter 2, verse 17. But here, 6 measures of barley. Apparently, 3 measures equals 1 ephah. So it was 2 ephahs then that she got from his hand. So she got twice as much laying his feet. And as Brother Ed had already mentioned, none of this needed to be winnowed or to be beaten out. And that's a precious thought, to think that the Lord will give us fresh thoughts with himself. As we lay at his feet in meditation and personal communion with himself. And then when she returns to her mother-in-law raises a question that may be perplexing to some. "Who art thou, my daughter?" her mother-in-law says as she comes home. You say, well, why wouldn't Naomi recognize her? Because been living with her for all this time. But yet she says, "Who art thou, my daughter?" Well, I think it's put this way to indicate to us that there is a moral change that takes place in our lives as we sit at the feet of Jesus, hear his word, that we are changed into his likeness and we're no longer the type of character that we were when the Lord first picked us up. How wonderful that is. And the New Testament tells us that it's by the Spirit and through our occupation with him that there is that silent work that goes on in us that we may not even be aware of particularly, but others notice a change. Here she is coming home with 2 ephahs of barley, and she can't even recognize her, so to speak. Wouldn't you like that kind of change to take place in your life and mine? Those would look upon us and see Christ and see that moral change. The verse I'm thinking of particularly is 2 Corinthians chapter 3 and verse 18. We with open face look on the Lord, and we are transformed into the same image from glory to glory by that same Spirit. Is that right?
Another thought could be expressed in maybe our language. Are you Mrs. Boaz or not? As Naomi was eagerly expecting and the report, and her interest is so great. Are you Mrs. Boaz or not?
There's a nice little touch at the end of verse 15. And the authorized it says, "And she went into the city." Draw your attention to Mr. Darby's translation. It says, "And he went into the city." It almost seems to suggest that now that he's won her affection, he's not going to wait until he can see this matter through. Remember when the prodigal was in the far country, and it tells us that he comes to the end of himself, when he was yet a great way off, the father ran. Well, that word for far country and the word for great way off is the same. It tells us this, that while he was yet in that far country, he might not have had to take a step, but his heart was changed, his affections were towards the father's house, and the father ran. That's what it was for that, isn't it? Didn't really have to take a step, but as soon as the father saw that there was some desire for him, for his house, and he ran. Well, here I just wonder if we might be able to draw this in. Boaz had seen now the willingness of Ruth maybe do some things that might be considered unusual to many around, but she had an affection for him. And when he saw that, he was going to, as soon as he could, see the matter through, because he found one who responded to himself. I think that's nice. I wondered if we could also draw a little thought in here. What city did the Lord go to be able to gain us for himself? Wasn't an easy city for him to go into, was it? They even took him out of that city. I just like to draw that in. He went to the city.
Ruth came into Naomi's presence, she must have had a radiant countenance and it's been touched upon. Naomi might have said to Ruth, "Ruth, I've never seen you look so beautiful." But I think what she actually said to Ruth went far beyond that. She has a word, couldn't find words to express it, and sometimes a question goes far beyond an answer. So just to have a sense of the Lord looking upon us, transformed before Him. And here we are in the closing moments of this dispensation. We're just quietly waiting for our Lord to call us home. I wonder if it's intelligent to say that we ought to be irresistible to Him. Could there be that state of soul and self-judgment and expectation with us that we would be irresistible to Him?
The expression, "lie down until the morning," perhaps would be hard for us by nature. It's hard for us by nature to wait on the Lord, for the Lord to act. There's that expression in the Song of Songs that says, "Wake not up, my beloved, until He sleeps." There's a time when the Lord will wake up when He sleeps, and He will keep asking, as John pointed out, with Boaz going to the city, there's no sleep. He rides to Bethlehem, and he will not. And Naomi captures the thought there, doesn't she, when she says that he will not be in rest until he's finished the thing this day. You think of, though the Lord at times asks us to the rest, to wait, and it may appear like he's asleep. It may appear like, perhaps, to our hearts, but doesn't he realize what's going on? Keep reading. We look at Mark chapter 4, we get an example of that, I believe, in the connection with the parable that he spoke at the end of chapter 4 of Mark. As the disciples were in the same ship that the Lord was, verse 36, "And when they had sent away the multitude, they took him even as he was in the ship. And there were also with him other little ships. And there arose a great storm of wind, and the waves beat into the ship, so that it was now full. And he was in the hinder part of the ship, asleep on the pillow. And they awakened and say unto him, Master, carest not that we perish? And he arose and rebuked the wind, and said unto the sea, Peace, be still. And the wind ceased, and there was a great calm. And he said unto them, Why are ye so fearful? How is it that ye have no faith? How much blessed it would have been, more blessed if they would have just waited for the Lord to awake in his time. But he was gracious, and woke, and rebuked the wind." You know, we see in the testimony the ship we speak of, we see storms come in. We know of it now, don't we? Storms are seeking to come in. You think of the waves beating into the ship. What stirs up the waves but the wind? Who is the prince and power of the air but Satan? He is seeking to stir up the restlessness of the flesh and to come in even to affect the testimony in a negative way. And it may appear that the Lord is asleep to these things, but He's not. He's in control. He's in the stern. That's where the control of the ship is. And so how wonderful if we can do like Ruth, to lie down until the morning. There'll be a time when our beloved will wake up, and He will act, and it will be swiftly, and it will be complete, and it will be perfect. And so how fitting it is for us now, this moment, to wait before the Lord and to seek that we might have the patience of God to wait upon His time and to wait until the morning when things will be clear and when He will move in perfection.
there was really nothing left for Boaz to do but to claim Ruth for himself and take her home. And the Lord has gone to the cross. He's paid the price. He's redeemed us, our souls. So we're waiting, according to the truth of the New Testament, for the redemption of our bodies at His coming, when we will be redeemed in the full sense of the word, that is, that the body as well will be relieved from the bondage of corruption and glorified like His marvelous glorified body. And then we're going to be taken home as well, and spend eternity with Him above the Father's house. But our portion is to sit still or to wait for the Lord's coming. Now, that doesn't mean that we are not busy seeking to do the Lord's will in our lives, that we should just be apathetic and don't be exercised. I think the thought here with sitting still is not allowing the restlessness of the flesh to spoil my enjoyment of the person that is coming to redeem my body and take me to His place. And as you mentioned, that word until, sit still, my daughter, until, it reminds me of these four little expressions that you find in the New Testament, till He comes. And it's quite an interesting study to follow them, that the Lord has asked us to do these four things till He comes. Remember in John 21, He says to Peter, and I think it's the exhortation there for all of us, that what is it to thee till I come? Follow thou me. The point is there is to follow Him till He comes. In the pathway, that is, walking with Him through this world. Then you turn over to Revelation 21. He says, no other doctrine. There are those who have such corrupted doctrines and so on. Revelation 2, verse 25, I believe it is. He says, hold fast that which thou hast till I come. There you have it again. So we're to hold fast to the deposit of truth that has been committed to us, and to maintain that in His absence till He comes. So there's another thing. Then you turn over to Luke 19, and you hear the little parable the Lord has, and He tells the disciples there that a certain man was going to a far country to receive a kingdom and to come back again. And in the interim, while he's away, he delivers to the servants these 10 pounds. And then he says, trade till I come. Trade till I come. There it is. The idea of using what we have for the Lord in service, whatever way we can. And some produced 10 pounds and 5 pounds, so the Lord will take account of our service for Him when He returns. And then the fourth one I've been thinking about is 1 Corinthians chapter 11, where we hear the apostle telling us that that the Lord had delivered to him this that we should break bread in remembrance of Him. And it says, as often as you eat this bread and drink this cup, you do show forth the Lord's death, there you have it again, till He comes. There's another thing He's asked us to do until He comes. So there are these things that really give us the whole responsibility and privilege of the Christian life, till He comes. That's what we're to be engaged with, till He comes for us. And then over top of it all, you could probably write that verse that you have in James 5. Be patient, therefore, till the coming of the Lord. Be patient, therefore, brethren, till the coming of the Lord. That's kind of what Ruth, the Naomi, was telling Ruth here, too, wasn't it?
Cross our pathway that we wonder how they're going to turn out. And think of this dear man Boaz going up to the gate, which is the place of judgment where everything is to be settled, and to find the kinsman walking by there. Providential, God works, He delights to work providentially, and you just see things fall into place. And so we think of Boaz pondering that day just how everything would turn out. It really seemed
on the level of impossible. That's where the Lord likes to put things for us, to show that with God all things are possible. Like if David in the great straits in his exile gave birth to the 46th Psalm, and in that psalm it says, "Be still and know that I am God."
I think another translation of that is, "Be silent before thy God and let him mold thee." The molding takes place as we are quiet before him. You notice that all she has to do is to claim his redemptive work. Now she is to be still. Boaz does everything. All Ruth does is accept his work, because Boaz is her kinsman redeemer. And so she is quietly at peace, and he goes about the business of obtaining her freedom, or winning it.
Think of that kinsman looking into Boaz's face. What kind of a countenance did he behold? You know, if you see someone that's peaceful, it's hard to deny them what they would like to have. In fact, I believe that peace is the greatest weapon that a Christian has. Am I right in that? Peace that passeth all understanding. So this kinsman, he uses the excuse that he didn't want to have his inheritance marred. He didn't want anything in his inheritance that would offend him, and he'd be willing to take it all, except for Ruth the Moabitess, if that would mar his inheritance. It's all right.
If Boaz came before us, Christ, what is nearer to us than this one who is nearer than Boaz? Be this in soft or celestial, who this, or what this nearer kinsman speaks of?
Would it be the law that man has embraced to himself? It wasn't originally so, was it? The Lord could say, "Hitherto have I borne thee on eagle's wings." But they wanted something that they could lay claim to and do themselves. It seemed more secure to them, but it wasn't.
It's a little verse that goes something like, "Run, jump, stand, the law demands, but gives us neither feet nor hands. The gospel speaks of better things, it bids us fly, and it gives us wings. The law is powerless in this situation. The Moabite could not be brought in if the law was going to have to stand in all of its fullness. Here we have one who comes in not so much in law, so the Lord never stepped outside of it, so to speak, but in grace he was able to bring one in, for the law couldn't do one thing to help."
These 10 men that speak, they're mentioned here in verse 2, Bernie, they could, along the line what you're thinking of, the 10 commandments are Boaz's witnesses to the incompetence of the law to accomplish our redemption. And all that law can do is keep Ruth out, and her case was hopeless unless grace alone interceded for her. And our brother was mentioning peace, and it's beautiful to notice, I think, throughout all the salutations of the apostles that they mention grace before peace. Peace only comes after the heart is fluttered with the understanding of grace.
In the hands of the law was tied in regards to receiving Ruth because of her ancestry. And is that not the kinsman when he says, less than one my known inheritance?
Think of what the law said according to James, to offend in one point, you're guilty of all. That is a fiery law.